which document, and when. Also, the CIA told Tolkachev only translations were distributed, not originals, and there were strict restrictions on who could even talk about the Tolkachev intelligence. The CIA insisted that the target recognition system that Tolkachev passed in March 1983 was not shown to experts in the U.S. government until well after the security scare at the Institute, so there could not have been a leak from the United States. The CIA's soothing words to Tolkachev were accurate as far as they went, describing the safeguards on distribution of his information to outsiders. But it did not even raise the idea of a betrayal from within. In the ops note, the CIA advised Tolkachev that if more threats or investigations appeared, he should halt his work and lie low. Despite the value of your information and the high esteem in which it is held by the most senior people in our government, your future welfare is a much more important concern to us, the CIA message said. If threatened, they added, do not hesitate to destroy all materials and cease activity on our behalf for as long as is necessary. But once again, the CIA and the military customers also wanted Tolkachev to produce more material if he could. The case officer gave Tolkachev two more loaded Tropel cameras, each concealed in a key fob. The case officer also passed to Tolkachev another 120,000 rubles to replace some of what he had burned at the dacha. The Moscow station stashed some ginseng in the package and offered Tolkachev health advice, urging him to relax and cut down on salt in his diet. We feel you are not only a colleague, but a friend. As such, we ask you to please take care of yourself. Tolkachev had destroyed the Pentax 35mm camera during the scare, leaving him only one method to photograph documents, using the two miniature Tropel cameras that Morris had given him the previous fall. He wrote in his ops note to the CIA that he had taken the chance and used them at work to copy documents that he could no longer smuggle out of the building because of the tight restrictions. However, his note was vague. He wrote that, from the point of view of security, it's more convenient for me to do the whole process standing up, not sitting down. It wasn't clear where he was standing up, or why. Tolkachev said he found it difficult to hold the tiny camera exactly 28 centimeters from the page while standing. He said that he flattened the top of a knitting needle of precisely the right length, then attached the camera to it with a rubber band, effectively making a tripod. Tolkachev said he feared the needle was casting a shadow on the page, so he took time to photograph some pages twice. Unfortunately, he said, when I was photographing the second time, I was in such a hurry that I may have forgotten to unscrew the cap from the camera lens. In the future, he wrote, he wouldn't shoot every page twice because of time. There's none to spare. He didn't say anything else about photography, and the CIA couldn't ask. He renewed his request for another Pentax 35mm camera. On April 27th, headquarters reported that the results from the two Tropels that Tolkachev had given the case officer were generally excellent, and one document was a winner. The handwritten notes he made from memory were very valuable and crammed with an extraordinary amount of minute detail. Our initial reaction after this preliminary reading is that C.K. Sphere has almost completely recovered from his scare of the past year, headquarters concluded, and is once again taking risks, i.e. photography in his lab, in his determination to inflict as much damage as possible on his system. In his ops note, Tolkachev was more focused on his personal problems than in the past. He was still thinking of surgery to correct his broken nose. You shouldn't be surprised if I come to one of the meetings with a straight nose, he wrote to the CIA. He then revealed he had suffered another health crisis. It's well known that health does not improve with age, he said, describing an attack of acute chronic antacid gastritis that hit him in March. I had high fever. I was sick for 2 weeks and didn't go to work, he said. After this crisis, The stomach pains continued for over a month. I was forced to go on a strict diet. A Soviet doctor had recommended rosehip and buckthorn oil, but the pharmacy shelves in Moscow were nearly empty. It's practically impossible to get these oils, even with a doctor's prescription. The medicine could be found on the black market, but Tolkachev didn't want to try it. "It would be great if you could obtain some rosehip and buckthorn oil for me," he said. Tolkachev also suffered from gum disease. His teeth hurt upon eating cold food, and he wanted a French medicine that also couldn't be found in Moscow, with instructions in Russian. He and his wife needed new eyeglasses, too. Tolkachev provided the prescriptions. His son needed 6 to 8 more bottles of India ink for his drafting equipment, and a bottle of fluid to clean the equipment the CIA had provided him earlier. The CIA was reassured by all these requests. A cable from headquarters to the Moscow station observed that Tolkachev has recovered his drive and is again determined to gather information for us according to a self-imposed timetable. Tolkachev seems to be exhibiting again a compulsive urgency to get on with his self-appointed task, headquarters said. They began to assemble the items on Tolkachev's list, adding the German equivalent of Digel and Maalox. In the summer of 1984, the CIA also changed Tolkachev's code name. Headquarters said it was a routine security procedure, because CK's fear had already been in use for 6 years. His new code name was CK Vanquish. By autumn, Tolkachev seemed to have rebounded. On October 11th, he met a case officer for 20 minutes, and the officer found him more healthy and energetic than in the spring. The case officer came bearing bulky packages for Tolkachev that included 168,750 rubles and much of his wish list. Tolkachev passed to the case officer 2 Tropel cameras with exposed film and 22 pages of handwritten material, including an ops note. He immediately asked about the Pentax camera and whether the case officer had brought it. He wanted it badly, but the CIA had decided not to give it to him, fearing he might take too many risks. Tolkachev insisted that with the coming of winter, he could resume smuggling documents out of the institute, tucked inside his coat, despite the dangers. He told the case officer that the security situation appeared to be calm at his institute, with no new investigations. When the case officer said he was worried about the dangers, Tolkachev reminded him anew, "Everything we do is dangerous." Then Tolkachev revealed why he was standing up when photographing documents with the Tropel cameras. He was taking the documents to a private men's toilet stall, locking the door, putting the documents on a narrow shelf under a tiny window, and photographing them with the miniature camera. In his ops note, Tolkachev pleaded with the CIA to bring the Pentax camera to their next meeting so he could be more productive, as he had in the past. Sure, he said, he could just make notes. That would be safe. But he added, "It's impossible to do a lot with such a method. While I've always strived from the very beginning to gather and to pass on the maximum information possible. And now, under conditions that are more difficult in comparison to the early period of my activity, my drive hasn't changed. I feel that I am already unable to lessen this drive. It is incited to some degree by the nature of my character. In this case, from my own experience, I am once more convinced of the accuracy and truth of proverbs, such as, for example, character cannot be broken." Tolkachev's photographs taken in the toilet were clear, except for a few frames where he failed to press the shutter down all the way. Headquarters said his note offered the clearest picture we have yet had of a man driven by the unchangeable nature of his character to disregard the risks he perceives in order to collect as much information as possible. But headquarters still balked at giving Tolkachev a Pentax to photograph documents. They decided on a compromise: give him more Tropel miniature cameras to use. Tolkachev's meeting in October, his 20th with the CIA, was businesslike. but he was not as personally warm and forthcoming as he had been with John Gilcher and David Rolfe. He didn't mention to the case officer that his son Oleg, who had figured so prominently in his requests over the years, was married in Moscow on August 1st at 19 years old, and moved out of the apartment to live with his new wife's parents. Tolkachev's notes gave headquarters a sense of renewed optimism about the operation. For the first time since 1982, he had answered the CIA's specific questions about Soviet weapon systems. The division's reports and requirements staff, which handled the incoming intelligence and outgoing questions for agents in the field, said Tolkachev's material would seem to indicate that he has recovered from his security crisis. The CIA also prepared an ops note for Tolkachev, emphasizing how valuable his material had become, and saying they didn't want him to take any unnecessary risks. "You should clearly understand," the ops note said, "that the information you provide to us, simply stated, is considered invaluable, prized not only by technical experts, but by those making national security policy." "To lose such information," the CIA said, "would be a severe blow to our government, gravely affecting our national posture, both now and for many years to come." Tolkachev was 5 minutes late to his meeting with the CIA case officer on the night of January 18, 1985. The streets were piled with snow, temperatures plunged to 15 degrees below zero, and he had trouble finding a place to park. When he arrived, they exchanged verbal paroles, a few pleasantries, and walked back to Tolkachev's car to stay warm and talk. Tolkachev asked right away, "Do you have the Pentax?" The case officer said no, it was too risky. Tolkachev was disappointed, but said he would abide by the decision, even though he yearned to return to the days of shooting dozens of rolls of film with the big camera, spreading documents out on the table in his apartment. The camera held by a clamp on the back of a chair, and with a good desk lamp to illuminate the pages. In the toilet stall at the Institute, where he was photographing with the Tropel cameras, the window was painted over in white. The light was soft on the best of days, and worse when it was overcast outside. The small, solitary toilet was located in a building adjacent to his office, so he could easily carry secret documents there. There were no document control points in between, but just in case, he usually arranged to make a cover stop at a friend's office to explain his presence in the building. In the toilet stall, he could lock the door and be alone. He told the case officer he had recently photographed a very important document using the small Tropel cameras. Tolkachev recited the title of the document from memory. "Overall Special Program of Scientific Research, Experimentation, and Practical Construction Work to Secure the Creation of Frontline and PVO Fighters for the 1990s. The PVO meant Air Defense Forces. The document would surely be another intelligence treasure for the CIA. Soviet military aviation plans, well into the next decade. Still, Tolkachev said the photographs were made on an overcast day, and he sounded uncertain about his use of the miniature cameras in the dim light. He gave the Tropel cameras to the case officer, as well as handwritten notes wrapped in a taped package. The case officer handed over several bundles to Tolkachev. 5 more miniature Tropel cameras, another 100,000 rubles, a meeting schedule for the next 3 years, and instructions for new signal and meeting sites, including a location for the next meeting planned for June, codenamed Trubka, or Pipe. The CIA's schedule and instructions were a clear indication that they planned to carry on with the operation for some time to come. The packages also included 3 books in Russian, and an ops note telling Tolkachev how invaluable and important his material had been to the United States. Tolkachev presented a long personal wish list to the CIA. He needed a rear window defroster for his car. He continued to suffer from pain in his teeth and wanted more French medicine. He asked for albums and books on architecture for his son. He wanted soft-tipped French pens, similar to those that had appeared the previous summer in Moscow. He gave a used pen to the case officer as a sample. Tolkachev also was hungry for news published in the West. He wanted press clippings and Russian-language newspapers printed in the United States. He asked for information on arms control, important speeches by Western leaders, and press conferences of Soviet citizens, refugees, and defectors in the West. Tolkachev said his son regarded his English teachers as very bad, and he asked the CIA to put together an extensive English language training course with cassette tapes, recording humorous stories and political speeches, all spoken by more than one person. He volunteered money from his escrow account to finance the work. In the ops note for Tolkachev, the Moscow station reported that his account balance stood at $1,990,729.85. Time was short. The case officer's tape recorder was running. He asked Tolkachev about some current rumors. Had he heard anything concerning the health of the Soviet leader Konstantin Chernenko? No, nothing, Tolkachev said. What about reports that red mailboxes on Moscow street corners were disappearing, and what did that mean? Tolkachev said he didn't write many letters and hadn't noticed. After 20 minutes, the case officer opened the car door and slipped away. It was Tolkachev's 21st meeting with the CIA. When the Moscow station opened Tolkachev's handwritten notes the next day, they found something odd. Pages he had numbered 1 to 10 were normal. Then the material skipped to pages 34 to 35, then skipped again to 52 to 57. They did not know why. On balance, however, it seemed that Tolkachev was back on track. When the Moscow station sent a cable to headquarters describing the meeting, Gerber, the Soviet division chief, read it and wrote at the top of the page, "Great." On January 31st, headquarters sent a message to the Moscow station saying, "We remain optimistic that Tolkachev's security crisis of 1983 has abated." Headquarters added, "We are especially pleased that the conditions for photography at the Institute are a lot better than they could have been, and it is encouraging that he is not required to pass any document control points on his way to the small toilet." Just a few days later, headquarters sent worrisome news. Tolkachev's latest film from the Tropel cameras turned out to be unreadable. The negatives were extremely underexposed, caused by lack of sufficient light. The cameras were simply not working in the dim light. The valuable document Tolkachev painstakingly photographed in the toilet stall was lost. Also, there was another unexplained puzzle. The Tropel cameras used a screw-on cap at one end. The end caps on two of the cameras were obviously switched, headquarters reported. Was it a mistake made in haste, or something else? At CIA headquarters, an internal review of Tolkachev's security situation, looking back over all the cables and notes of the last 4 years, was completed in February and sent to the Moscow station. It examined the system of building passes and library permission sign-out sheets for secret documents that Tolkachev had previously described. Although Tolkachev had been astoundingly successful at smuggling documents out of the Institute and photographing them at home for several years, the review cautioned that the authorities have established a series of interlocking restrictions and checkpoints that would make it more difficult to smuggle documents out of the Institute. The review added that, "We are encouraged by the news that C.K. Vanquish apparently can move freely within the Institute grounds." It insisted that the CIA be vigilant and look for ways to lessen the danger to Tolkachev. Yet the review focused entirely on the risks to him by his own actions within the Institute and said nothing about the dangers to him from elsewhere. The CIA mindset was that security at its own headquarters was very tight, and it was unthinkable that a leak could come from Langley or the military customers who thrived on Tolkachev's intelligence. On March 4th, the Moscow station put up a visual signal for Tolkachev, asking for a quick meeting. The station wanted to tell him that the last batch of film did not turn out, and give him a new light meter and cameras with improved film for low light conditions. We believe chances are very good that C.K. Vanquish would be able to resume successful photography in the relatively secure conditions of the toilet, headquarters said. But for some reason, Tolkachev did not respond. The next week, the station saw a ready signal, although the officer wasn't sure because it was not the same for Tochka as before, but it was opened at the proper time. Again, Tolkachev didn't show. An alternative meeting date passed at the end of March, and he didn't show up again. Chapter 18. Selling Out. In January 1985, Edward Lee Howard flew to Vienna to meet with his Soviet contacts. Howard told his wife Mary that the KGB wanted to check his bona fides and verify the information he was giving them. He was reimbursed by the KGB for his travel expenses, but he was told they would have to verify his material before he would be paid more. What exactly happened in Vienna is not known, but as Howard later described it to his wife, he was picked up in front of a movie theater and driven around for about half an hour to check for surveillance. He was impressed with the tradecraft. He was taken in through a back door to the Soviet embassy, where he talked with two officers who debriefed him. He identified them as Boris and Viktor for 3 or 4 hours. They made him feel important, treated him with respect, poured drinks, and brought him caviar. One of the two men had flown in from Moscow. Howard said the Soviet officers were still not totally convinced of his bona fides because they had been unable to verify some of his information. He said he was to be paid a considerable amount of money at a later meeting. From abroad, Howard sent a postcard to a friend that said, "I talked to my case officer." In April, Howard returned to Vienna, this time accompanied by Mary. She recalled that he paid for everything using traveler's checks, not his American Express credit card. They stayed at the 4-star Hotel Beethoven for 2 days. Howard had filled out an application for employment with the United Nations Agency in Vienna and written to them, saying he would be available for an interview on April 25, 1985. Once in the city, Howard's wife dropped him off at the UN office, but that was just a cover story. Howard had earlier called the United Nations and canceled his interview. He apparently met with the Soviet officers again at this time. Howard later wrote that he also went to Zurich, Switzerland, and indulged a long-time fantasy of mine and spent $600 on a Rolex watch. Howard had much to offer the KGB. He knew of the presence of a spy for the United States deep in the Soviet military-industrial complex, and he knew of the presence of a wiretap on one of the Soviet Union's most sensitive underground communications lines. Howard was trained at the CIA for both operations. He knew much of the CIA's operational tradecraft and technology, such as the use of the tiny radios, disguises, surveillance detection runs, and the jack-in-the-box. In 1984 and 1985, Howard confided to a friend, William Bosch, a former CIA case officer in Latin America who left the agency under a cloud, that he had sold information to the Soviets. Howard met Bosch several times in this period, boasting of his KGB contacts. He told Bosch how his vacation in Milan was a cover for action, that he filled a dead drop for the Soviets and had taken secret CIA documents and buried them for later passage to the KGB. Howard tried at least once to recruit Bosch to join him and go and see Boris, my case officer. Bosch later expressed worry about Howard's mental stability and wasn't sure if Howard was joking or serious. But Bosch, who had his own troubles with the CIA, never reported any of this to the authorities. With the information obtained from Howard, the KGB began to look for a spy inside a vast network of military research institutes, design bureaus, and factories spread across 11 time zones. Although the KGB had served as the cruel hammer of Soviet repression, they had become more legalistic and procedural over the decades. They would not make a move based on Howard's tip alone. They were seeking evidence, and they wanted to catch a spy in the act. Howard apparently described to the KGB some details about Tolkachev, but did not, or could not, provide his name. Howard later claimed he didn't know the name. The KGB was left with a vague description of the spy they were hunting for. Several participants later recalled that they began with a broad investigation that examined both aviation and electronics branches of the defense industry, but then narrowed it down to one institute, Positron. Just as the KGB was learning more from Howard, another American intelligence officer stepped forward with new information. On April 16, 1985, Aldrich Ames went to the bar of the Mayflower Hotel in downtown Washington. A tall man with a mustache and heavy eyeglasses, he was head of a counterintelligence branch inside the Soviet division at CIA headquarters. Ames was regarded by colleagues as a rather bland and mediocre intelligence officer. At the hotel bar, he waited for a Soviet diplomat to show up. When the man didn't come, Ames walked two blocks to the Soviet embassy on 16th Street Northwest. He handed an envelope to the receptionist and motioned to the duty officer that he wanted it given to the KGB resident upstairs. Inside the envelope, Ames offered to become an agent for the Soviet Union, describing two or three cases involving Soviets who had approached the CIA to offer their services, but not Tolkachev. Ames also included a page from the CIA internal phone directory that identified him. He asked for $50,000. Ames returned to the embassy on May 15th, and meeting the KGB in a soundproof room, was told he would get the money. 2 days later, the KGB gave it to him in $100 bills at a restaurant. Up to this point, Ames had given the Soviets some hints of his potential, but not a large quantity of secret materials. He had not disclosed such operations as CK Vanquish and CK Elbow, but he certainly offered the promise of more. In the spring and summer of 1985, CIA headquarters was confronted with a string of anomalies, all related to espionage against the Soviet Union. There was no single credible explanation, and some of the events might not have been connected to Howard and Ames. At this point, the CIA did not know that either of them was committing treason, but the events of 1985 came quickly and sent a shudder through headquarters. What worried them most were the anomalies that they couldn't explain. In May, Sergei Bokhan, a longtime CIA agent in Athens who was serving in the GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence, was unexpectedly summoned to Moscow. Bokhan was told his son was in trouble at a military academy, but he knew that was false. Had he been betrayed? Would he be arrested in Moscow? Bokhan consulted with the CIA, and in a decision approved by Gerber, the division chief, in just a matter of days, Bokhan was exfiltrated by the CIA to the United States. Also in April, a case officer in the Moscow station, Michael Sellers, met a KGB source who called himself Stas, whose real identity was not known to the CIA. He was a rough-cut officer with a guttural street jargon Russian that wasn't easy to understand, but Sellers managed to grasp it, and they walked around Moscow and talked for an hour and a half undetected, as Stas provided a stream of valuable intelligence, including the disclosure that the Moscow station had made a major error in another operation. Just as they were getting ready to part, Stas took out what looked like a small can and a plastic bag and sprayed something into it. He informed Sellers it was a sample of a mysterious powder the KGB used to track officers of the Moscow station. The invisible chemicals were sprinkled by the KGB on car door handles and other locations. A special light exposed the spy dust on a doorknob, a telephone, or a bus window. Sellers had seen the stuff before in his car, even on a child's car seat. It looked like yellow bee pollen. But now the United States had proof. Why had Stas volunteered? Who was he? It wasn't clear. In the spring, a case officer from the Moscow station made a run to the underground cable tap. With an electronic device, the case officer interrogated the recorder about tampering, and it responded with an alarm. The sensor wasn't perfect, and it could be a false alarm, but the case officer decided to abort the run. After a debate, the Moscow station decided to try again, figuring that an espionage machine that had cost tens of millions of dollars was worth the risk. The case officer returned to the site and safely retrieved the recorder, and it was sent back to the United States. But the valuable intelligence that had been picked up for years on the underground cable had completely dried up. No one knew why. Amid these jarring events and unanswered questions, the CIA decided not to bother Tolkachev until the next scheduled rendezvous, set for June. The summer months would bring more daylight, and the CIA might be able to give him new film or a better camera. The Moscow station and headquarters seemed optimistic that they could solve the photography problem, even if it meant urging Tolkachev to take pictures in the toilet only on sunny days. Chapter 19. Without Warning. On the evening of March 10, 1985, the ailing Soviet leader Konstantin Chernenko passed away. The next day, the youngest member of the Politburo, Mikhail Gorbachev, became the fourth leader of the Soviet Union in 3 years. Tolkachev usually paid little attention to politics. At home, he was content to bury himself in his technical books, ignoring broadcasts and pronouncements of the party state. He loathed them all, and rarely even glanced at a television. He was not an optimist that the Soviet system would change. But when it did, he took notice. After the arrival of Gorbachev, he could not get enough of the television news. One day at home, he marveled, "Did you notice this concert on television? There were no propaganda songs." Frequently, he read the newspapers, which he hadn't done for years. He was curious and excited about Gorbachev and the hints of new thinking. Could it be that their dashed hopes from the days of the thaw would be realized at last? On Wednesday, June 5th, the next date for a planned meeting with Tolkachev, the Moscow station checked the Fortochka. This time, the correct window was open, a signal that he was ready. But that evening, the case officer had to abort, saying there was too much surveillance. Over the weekend of June 8th and 9th, Tolkachev and his wife Natasha drove to their dacha north of Moscow. Their son Oleg no longer joined them for trips to the country. While Tolkachev and his wife were away, KGB officers secretly entered and searched their apartment. They discovered the fountain pen with the L pill from the CIA. They might also have found the other CIA materials in the entresol, including the schedule and maps for upcoming meetings. A family friend recalled that at the dacha, Adik often worked with wood, repairing window frames, while Natasha liked to cultivate the garden. They had plans on Sunday evening, June 9th, to see old friends in Moscow, the Roshanskys. When they left the dacha, Adik put on a light sport coat and his wife a black and white check dress with trim at the sleeves, anticipating they would meet their friends soon after their return to the city. Natasha had only recently obtained a driver's license and was behind the wheel of the Zhiguli. The country had been cool for the weekend, and as they drove, it was drizzling. The Zhiguli's wipers were on. On a narrow two-way road toward the city, which cut through a stand of pine and birch, they were stopped by a traffic policeman wearing a uniform and a rain cape, who waved them over with a baton. A traffic police checkpoint was not unusual, although it was not often found so far out in the country. The ochre Zhiguli approached the checkpoint, pulled over as instructed, and braked jerkily behind a parked blue and white police van. The traffic policeman saluted and asked the owner of the car to get out. Adik and Natasha sat inside quietly for a moment, and then Adik climbed out on the passenger side. He was wearing his sport coat and appeared to slide something, perhaps his documents, into his left inside coat pocket after he got out of the car. The policeman directed him to step forward of the blue and white van, toward other vehicles parked along his shoulder. Tolkachev took about 10 strides in that direction, with the traffic policeman in front of him. Tolkachev raised his left hand and scratched the right side of his chin. At that moment, a young man with black hair and a mustache briskly strode up behind him, holding a white rag in his left hand. The man threw his right arm around Tolkachev's neck into a chokehold, and with his left hand stuffed the white rag into Tolkachev's mouth. 3 others grabbed Tolkachev's arms and yanked them behind him, lifted his feet off the ground, and carried him back toward the van. The rag still in his mouth, Tolkachev was silent. The side doors to the blue and white van swung open, and Tolkachev was shoved inside. His wife was escorted away from the Zhiguli into another car. As she prepared to climb into the other vehicle, she looked up, confused. None of the men who stopped them were traffic police. They were all KGB. In the van, still restrained by the KGB man's arm around his neck, Tolkachev was stripped of his clothing to make sure he was not carrying a suicide pill. The KGB remembered well how Ogorodnik tricked them years earlier with the poison concealed in a fountain pen. They put Tolkachev in a tracksuit. Tolkachev was then driven in the blue and white van to Lefortovo, the KGB's notorious prison in Moscow. Once there, he redressed in his street clothes, after they were checked again for a suicide pill. When the Tolkachevs did not telephone and did not show up to see the Roshanskys on Sunday, their friends began to call the apartment at Ploschad Vostanaya. There was no answer. They tried to call Natasha at work on Monday. No answer. On Monday morning, at the institute, Natasha's supervisor, Vladimir Libin, took note that she was absent. Libin was also a family friend who had visited the Tolkachevs at home and privately shared Natasha's deep antipathy toward the system. Libin gave her the benefit of the doubt and wrote compensatory time on her records, figuring there was a good reason she did not come to work. It could be that someone became ill, a car malfunctioned, anything. In the middle of the day, a woman telephoned Libin, saying she was a neighbor of the Tolkachevs at the dacha, that Adik was ill, he had been taken to the local hospital, and asked that his wife be given some time off. For 2 more days, Libin marked her down for more time off. On Wednesday, frantic, the Roshanskys drove to the Tolkachevs' dacha. It was locked. The village was very small, and everyone knew everything about each other. Neighbors said they had seen nothing unusual. Tolkachev had left with his wife on Sunday, carrying flowers back to the city. Did the car break down? The Roshanskys went to the local auto shop. No, there were no incidents on Sunday, neither breakdowns nor accidents. They went to the local hospital. Again, nothing. The Roshanskys returned to Moscow and went to the Tolkachev's apartment building. The ochre Zhiguli was not in its usual parking space. On Wednesday, June 12th, Natasha telephoned Libin at work. She said Adik had been stricken with severe back pain, and she didn't know when she could return to work. Libin expressed his sympathy. Her voice sounded weak, less than cheerful. With no word, after days and days of calling friends, the Roshanskys went back to the Tolkachev apartment. With relatives who had a key to the apartment, they opened the first of 2 doors to enter it. But they stopped on the inner door. It was marked with paper seals, on which were visible 3 bold letters. KGB. Oleg had also been searching for his parents when they did not return from the dacha. He too went to their apartment and saw the KGB seal on their door. Tolkachev's next scheduled meeting with the CIA was to be June 13th, the day after Natasha had called the institute to say Adik was sick. In anticipation, the Moscow station drafted an ops note, which began, "Dear friend," and praised Tolkachev's material delivered in January, which was considered to be extremely valuable by our national security experts. But the Moscow station informed Tolkachev the photographs of that very important document had not come out due to insufficient light levels caused by the extremely overcast weather during the winter. The station said that headquarters was working on a new, more light-sensitive camera, but in the meantime, they would give him 5 more Tropel cameras, like those he had used before. They urged him to photograph on bright days only. "We remain extremely interested in the very important documents you photographed for our last meeting," the ops note said. "Please take those pictures again," it added, "when you are certain conditions are absolutely secure." The ops note for Tolkachev also raised the possibility of another CIA attempt to replicate Tolkachev's library permission sheet so he could replace it with the original, as we did in 1980. The materials for Tolkachev this time were bulky. The station packaged everything carefully. The ops note, the cameras, 4 pages of original material he had provided to the CIA in January being returned, 20 French drawing pens, 20 German drawing pens, 2 architecture books, 8 boxes of dental medicine and instructions, 8 bottles of fluoride, 8 tubes of toothpaste, a book containing 250 pages of newspaper and magazine articles from the West, and 100,000 rubles toward interest on his escrow account. But the CIA told Tolkachev they were reluctant to provide the English language lessons he wanted for his son because of concern about how he would explain where he got them. The tapes were not in the package. Tolkachev's Fortochka window was open on June 13th at the correct hour, signaling that he was ready for a meeting that evening. But KGB surveillance on the case officers selected for the meeting had been so heavy that the station picked an alternate case officer. There was always a primary and an alternate, and sometimes a third. In this case, the job fell to Paul Skip Stonebaugh, a case officer who, before joining the CIA, had worked for the FBI. Stonebaugh was well-liked, a straight-arrow, hard-working type. His Russian language skills weren't great, but his colleagues remembered his tenacity in studying. In Moscow, he became a sort of hybrid officer, undercover in the embassy's political section, but not strictly deep cover. He had his own desk in the Moscow station, and in 1985, having passed the initial period of KGB scrutiny, was spending about half his time in the station, a colleague recalled. That week in June, the Moscow station chief made a trip out of town to the southern Caucasus Mountains region. The KGB would have been notified, and the station chief hoped to distract them from operations in Moscow. On the evening of June 13th in Moscow, Stonebaugh set out on a long surveillance detection run, carrying 2 large Russian shopping bags with handles. He was wearing a white shirt and sport coat. While many case officers tried to disguise themselves to look Russian on the street at times like this, in drab clothes and with thick eyeglasses, Stonebaugh did not. He looked very much like an American diplomat. He was driven on the first leg of the run by his wife, then proceeded on foot. Stonebaugh reached the meeting site, codenamed Trubka, or Pipe, about an hour early. It was located in a residential area of 5-story apartment blocks in western Moscow, 4.5 miles from Tolkachev's home, farther out than in the earlier days. The meeting was to be at 2 payphones. Stonebaugh walked past the meeting site, making an initial check, noticing nothing unusual. He then waited on a park bench until 9:40 p.m. Leading to the meeting place was a broad sidewalk under a canopy of trees, with apartment buildings on all sides. Puddles still remained on the sidewalk from recent thundershowers. As Stonebaugh walked, slowly, toward the site, he noticed a young red-haired woman talking on one of the payphones. He thought it was odd that she was talking so loudly on an otherwise quiet street, but he did not change course or move away from her. Under his right arm, Stonebaugh cradled one of the bags for Tolkachev and grasped the other in his left hand by the handle. He walked just beyond the woman on the phone, then turned on his heel and took a few steps back in the other direction, all the while looking up and around for Tolkachev. He saw what looked like Tolkachev's ochre Ziguli car parked 100 to 200 yards away. Three plainclothes men ambushed Stambaugh, leaping out from a row of bushes. One pulled Stambaugh's arms behind him sharply, while the other two wrested free the packages. Five more men, all from the KGB, rushed to the scene. Stambaugh was hustled into a van, which drove off to the Lubyanka, the KGB headquarters building. In the van, Stambaugh protested that he was an American diplomat. A KGB man told him to shut up. He didn't want to hear it. Stambaugh was ushered into a holding room in the Lubyanka and searched. The KGB removed from his pockets his tape recorder, a plain plastic Tropel camera, some change, cryptic notes he had made before the meeting on possible dead drop sites for the future, his meeting agenda, some medicine for Tolkachev in his right-hand coat pocket, a black felt-tip pen, two pages of a Moscow map, and his watch, wallet, and belt. After an hour in the holding room, Stambaugh was taken to a conference room and told to sit down. Spread out in front of him were the items taken from his pockets and the two packages for Tolkachev, still unopened. Rem Krasilnikov, the major general who led KGB counterintelligence, declared, "You have been arrested for committing espionage. Who are you?" Stambaugh, "American diplomat. I want to call the embassy, now." Krasnilikov, "You are not a diplomat, you are a spy." Stambaugh, "I am a diplomat." Krasnilikov, "You are a spy." Stambaugh, with his sport coat folded over his arm, flexed his shoulders, obviously sore. His arms had been pinned behind his back for the first hour of his detention. The KGB turned on a video camera. Krasnilikov then proceeded to open the two packages, carefully examining each item inside. When he opened the second package, those present in the room stared in awe at the bulging stack of rubles. Holding the brick of currency sealed in plastic, Krasilnikov said, "A huge bundle of 50-ruble notes." He asked Stambaugh about the plastic Tropel camera, and Stambaugh refused to answer. Krasilnikov then took out the ops note and read the first two lines aloud, thanking the agent for valuable information at the last meeting. Krasilnikov read the rest of the letter in silence, until he reached a line about the CIA's reluctance to give the agent English-language training materials, and read it out loud. Krasilnikov also found the notes handwritten by Tolkachev containing intelligence information, the pages given to the CIA in January that had been oddly numbered. The CIA was returning them to Tolkachev at his request. Krasilnikov commented that they were most interesting. The Soviet Foreign Ministry notified the U.S. Embassy that an American had been detained by the KGB. When an embassy duty officer came to the Lubyanka to get Stambaugh, a heated confrontation erupted. Krasilnikov kept insisting Stambaugh was a spy, and the embassy duty officer demanded they be allowed to leave. The embassy officer was told by Krasilnikov that Stambaugh had been detained in the act of meeting with a Soviet citizen for alleged espionage purposes, and the Soviet citizen in question had been arrested. Just before the ambush, the KGB had put an impersonator on the street to resemble Tolkachev, carrying the recognition signal, a book with a white cover in his left hand. The KGB also opened the fortochka in Tolkachev's window and parked Tolkachev's car nearby as additional enticement. Stambaugh saw the car, but didn't see the fake Tolkachev. He thought he had been free from surveillance, but the KGB was waiting. A flash cable was sent to CIA headquarters reporting an arrest. A longer cable was sent to headquarters after Stambaugh was released, describing the ambush. Stambaugh was released after midnight, Moscow time, declared persona non grata, and expelled. The incident carried an ominous meaning for those who knew of the Moscow station's most valued asset. The KGB had the exact time and place where Stambaugh was to meet the agent. It meant the Tolkachev operation was over. He was already in the grip of the KGB. That same afternoon, Aldrich Ames arrived at a small restaurant, Chadwick's, on the Georgetown waterfront in Washington. Ames had wrapped up a bundle of classified messages in his CIA office and carried them out of headquarters without being stopped. He brought the cables and documents in a plastic bag to the restaurant, where he was met by Sergei Chuvakin from the Soviet embassy. Ames gave him the materials, a colossal breach that was just the beginning of his treachery. The KGB had already detained Tolkachev, but if they had any doubts, Ames gave them further confirmation. That evening, Gerber was at home on Connecticut Avenue in Washington. His wife Rosalie was cooking, expecting a guest for dinner, James Olson, who had worked with them in the Moscow station. Olson was the first case officer to climb into the manhole for CK Elbow, and had also met Shymov in Moscow and worked with Rolf on the CK Utopia exfiltration. After dinner, Gerber and Olson were scheduled to participate in an exercise on the streets of Washington, providing training in detecting, evading, and escaping surveillance to the next generation of CIA case officers. Gerber was to play the role of a spy, and the young trainees would attempt to find him while dodging or escaping the surveillance provided by the FBI. On a warm summer evening, the exercise would require a few hours out on the streets, teaching the rookies the exacting, choreographed methods that Gerber had polished over a long career. Olson arrived with a grim face at Gerber's apartment. The first thing he said was, "Terrible news. The CIA had just received the message from the Moscow station that Stambaugh had been arrested." Gerber realized instantly what that meant. Tolkachev had been lost. Gerber cared passionately about his country and about agents who risked their lives for it. A Roman Catholic, he often lit a candle at Mass for agents who had been killed in the line of duty. But after a career in espionage, he was also determined not to let setbacks slow him down. He often compared the work to that of a surgeon or a cancer doctor. He did everything he could to save the patient, but if and when a patient died, he moved on to save the next. Gerber always felt it necessary to soldier on, even with the burden of loss. He did not torment himself over whether he should have done something differently. He knew there would be all kinds of questions about Tolkachev in the morning. For now, he and Olson headed out to the street to prepare future CIA case officers in how to run a spy. In the weeks that followed, the Moscow station and headquarters attempted to puzzle out what might have compromised Tolkachev. The cables and messages were defensive and inconclusive. The reports and requirements branch in the division, responsible for sharing intelligence with the customers, emphasized that all of CK Vanquish's material has been disseminated on an extremely limited basis, and that all of the customers made a conscientious effort to keep down the number of people cleared. On July 8th, headquarters wrote to the Moscow station, "We cannot state definitively what might have caused his compromise." One possibility, headquarters said, was that Tolkachev was compromised at work through discovery of his intelligence-gathering activities, and another was that he was discovered as a result of a security investigation at Fazatron. Perhaps the investigation in early 1983 that had so frightened Tolkachev was still going on in early 1985 and exposed him. There was one more embarrassing possibility. 3 pages of the master copy of a top-secret Tolkachev document were lost in July 1984 when they were sent to the CIA's printing and photography division. The contents of the pages were specific enough to compromise CK Vanquish, headquarters noted. No one knew what happened to those 3 pages. Did Tolkachev make a mistake with all his money from the CIA? Headquarters didn't think so. Lavish spending does not seem to accord with what we know of C.K. Vanquish's character and conservative lifestyle, or with his statements from time to time that he viewed the money we gave him as a nest egg, or insurance against adversity, headquarters told the station. Was Tolkachev already under control by the KGB at the January 1985 meeting, when he turned over the cameras with the end caps switched and the film blurred? Headquarters thought this was not likely, given the high value of the potential intelligence to the United States. The KGB didn't like to dangle agents who could relinquish really important secrets. All of the headquarters' messages at this point were speculative and largely wrong. None of them focused on the possibility that Tolkachev was betrayed from within the CIA. But one observation was very accurate. Because the KGB knew the time, date, and place of the June 13th meeting with Tolkachev, they must have discovered the materials the CIA gave Tolkachev in January, including the meeting sites, ops note, and schedule. All of it was terribly incriminating. The arrest, therefore, came without warning. Chapter 20. On the Run. On August 1, 1985, Vitaly Yurchenko went for a stroll from the Soviet embassy in Rome and never returned. He had recently been named deputy director for the KGB department that ran Soviet spies in the United States and Canada. From the street, he called the U.S. embassy and said he wanted to defect to the United States. A quiet and dignified officer, Yurchenko was debriefed by the CIA before being flown from Naples, Italy, to Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington. Alerted to the defection, Gerber remained late in his office at CIA headquarters waiting for details. Sometime after 8 p.m., the cable secretariat called and said new messages had come in. Gerber walked down the stairs to get them, and as he climbed the stairs back to his office, he opened the envelope, found the most recent cable, and began to read. He felt his throat tighten. The cable reported that Yurchenko told the debriefers that the KGB had a very good source, codenamed Robert. Yurchenko did not know the true name of the source, but identified him as a disgruntled former CIA trainee who was in the pipeline for the Moscow station and was subsequently fired. Gerber suddenly felt overcome with emotion. He immediately put the pieces together. The KGB source was Edward Lee Howard, and he had betrayed Tolkachev. After all they had done to protect Tolkachev, after all the concealments, identity transfers, surveillance detection runs, electronic communications gear, Tropel cameras, and messages urging Tolkachev to be careful, the billion-dollar spy had been destroyed by one of their own, by a failed trainee. Yurchenko's mention of the mystery agent Robert led to an internal meeting at the CIA. The CIA's quasi-independent security office wasn't yet convinced of the link and said there were several possible suspects, but Gerber was adamant. "This is undoubtedly Howard," he insisted. The clue was unambiguous. Yurchenko was talking about a trainee who had been fired and was in the pipeline for assignment to Moscow. That description fit Howard perfectly. More than 2 years had passed since Howard had been forced out of the CIA, and for a long time the agency's attitude was to keep its problems to itself. Now, the CIA informed the FBI they had a problem. The person known as Robert was Edward Lee Howard, but the hour was late. Howard's next planned meeting with the Soviets was to be in Mexico City, but he sent them a signal, changing it to Vienna. He flew there on August 6, 1985. Howard took with him his own handwritten notes about CIA matters on water-soluble paper, a trick he had learned in training. According to his wife, Mary, he received $100,000 on this trip. On August 12th, he opened a Swiss bank account in Zurich and made a large deposit. The Soviets had a word of caution for Howard. one of their own officers had defected to the United States. Howard was told if he ever felt he was in trouble, he should go to any Soviet consulate. On his return to New Mexico, Howard bought a metal ammo box and put inside $3,100 in $100 bills.